Welcome to Conversations at Basecamp, the professional development podcast designed to help you confidently ascend the corporate climb. I'm Kim Havens.
And I'm Noah Reese, and we're the co-founders of Kahila, a digital platform providing leadership development for people on the rise.
This podcast is your exclusive look into our Basecamp for intentional career growth.
Each week, we'll dive into essential topics to master high-impact power skills, and we'll also decode leadership secrets and navigate game-changing trends to future-proof our careers.
So, whether you're a seasoned professional seeking to refine your approach to leadership development, or an ambitious person charting your course, Conversations at Basecamp empowers you with actionable insights and tangible takeaways.
Hello and welcome. I'm Harriet Cole, Director of Programming here at Kahila. So happy to have all of you here with us for what promises to be a dynamic conversation. C-suite secrets to navigating office politics. Don't you want to know from somebody who's in the know? Well, let me tell you who's going to be with us today. Joining us today is business executive, impact investor, and community leader, Betty Francisco. Betty is known as a powerful convener and changemaker who is unapologetic about creating visibility for entrepreneurs and investors of color. Betty served as a member of the senior executive team for Sports Club LA and Reebok Sports Club New York, a luxury fitness and lifestyle brand with 7 clubs nationwide. She has advised the CEO and board of directors on all major business initiatives, strategic partnerships, development, and mergers and acquisitions. Today, Betty is here to talk to us about perhaps one of the most challenging parts of being a business executive in the corporate world. Yes, navigating office politics. Please join me in welcoming Betty Francisco.
Good afternoon, Harriet. It's great to be here.
This is really welcoming you back, Betty. Some folks may have been here. Yes, thank you for all those cheers. Some folks may have been here when you and your husband were talking to us across both the men's and women's platform here at Kahila about navigating your life as a power broker corporate couple, which was really wonderful. And we loved you so much, we wanted you to come back.
Well, it's exciting to be back, and I'm excited about the conversation today.
Yeah. And so one of the things that I'd love for you to do is just tell us a little bit about your background so that we get a framework for who you are and how you have built your career.
Sure. So I'm actually originally from New York. I live in Boston now. I thought for the longest time that I wanted to be a lawyer. And so that's how I shaped my career path. I went to college. I studied history. I became really interested in how law could have an impact on people, especially immigrants, because my mother is Puerto Rican, my father's Chinese. I thought I could use it, right, to do good and change the world. And I ended up starting my first job out of college at the DA's office in New York, the Manhattan DA's office, which is one of, you know, the most renowned district attorney offices in the world. And talk about politics there. That was laden with politics. I worked for the counsel to the DA. And I ended up with a very coveted role that fostered a lot of jealousy, let's say, amongst peers. And I had to learn to navigate that as a very young person, right? It was my first job with folks that, you know, had been career civil servants, basically, right. And lots of different politics in government that carry over into corporate as well.
But let's dive into that for a moment, because Betty, some of the Kahila members are early in their careers. And this is one of those things that people don't talk about that much. When you are young and female, you walk in the door smart and people can be gunning for you from the very beginning. Well, who does she think she is? Yes. So how did you navigate that?
So I was a paralegal, basically. I was working on a very new program at the DA's office, which way back at the time, it was to reduce police overtime, right? So basically they started this super innovative program. If you get arrested, usually you have to go into the precinct, you get fingerprinted and booked and all that. You get arraigned, you could be there 24, 48 hours. Meanwhile, police officers are racking up overtime. to get your case into the courts. So to save money, the state of New York and the city of New York started this program. Instead of doing all that, the police officer would write a ticket and explain what happened. So I was the one processing these cases. And I was kind of doing the work of an assistant district attorney as a paralegal. So that was one. It was like, why does she get to do that? The second is I was working with a counsel to the DA who was someone a lot of people wanted to get access to. Very lucky. I got to work hand in hand with him, but partly I built the relationship. I proved myself that I could do it, that I was rigorous in what he wanted to get done. And then also that I could help grow the program. A lot of jealousy ensued though. People that even were peers to him started to say things because I worked so closely that I was having some relationship with him. I mean, talk about like spreading rumors. So the way I even learned that this was happening is I had peers, right? So I think in any role, having peers that have ears to the ground that are very connected, I had like the political butterflies looking out for me. Right. And those were friends. Like you start to build relationships at the peer level, maybe a little bit more senior, but they're people that you know are looking out for you and they tell you what's happening. And so that is how I started to navigate and understand that there's a whole political system in every workplace, right? Some people care about you, some people don't. Some people are out to get you because they're jealous, they just don't like you, whatever. And so you have to figure out how do I play to that and actually build a relationship. You may not want to build a relationship, but you start to play the politics back.
Well, like they sometimes say, keep your enemies closer.
Close. Yeah. Yeah. Your friends close, your enemies closer, right? Closer. Yeah. So that's the learning early on that I had, right? That I knew that in the workplace, there are certain people that are always in the know. And you have to find them because they tell you the politics and culture, the unwritten rules of a workplace that, you know, you're not going to find it in the handbook. You're not going to see it in an orientation, but it's like this understood thing that only others can share with you. And later in my career, so after the DA's office, I went to law school and I got my first job in a law firm. And different in a firm, right, than maybe in a corporate environment, you're still working, you know, I was a transactional lawyer working with, you know, big corporate clients, mergers, acquisitions, venture capital deals. And the politics there was really around how do you work with the lawyers that the partners, right, the senior partners that can give you really good work. You want to be seen as the attorney and associate that gets like the cutting edge deals. Mm-hmm. Or the cutting edge cases, right? So how do you get that? So part of the early career there was building my reputation as a doer, someone that was reliable, that got things done, that would sort of, I mean, this is different now in our multi-generational culture. At the time, I mean, I'm a Gen X and you work your ass off. Like you stay really late. There's lots of sacrifices I made, right? To prove myself. Whereas I think in younger generations now feel really differently about giving.
But let's dig into that a little bit because, and maybe I'm old school, but I'll admit to being that.
Yeah.
Is it ever going to be true that you don't have to work extra hard in order to climb that ladder? I don't know.
I mean, I think that being in a multi-generational workplace now, like I'm trying to respect that other view that you can work hard to a point and you have to have boundaries because the way we worked, we had no boundaries, right? So that's the problem.
That's true.
Right. And that's why we hated our jobs after a certain point. So it's how do you create other opportunities to build a life, have some balance, still do really good work, be able to innovate, you know, like now in the space that I'm in, which is very much, you know, the nonprofit impact world, we talk about rest as resistance, right? Like that should translate into the corporate role too. Like rest is innovation or, you know, so you've got to slow down sometimes to really be effective.
But one other question along that line. With COVID and, you know, folks going home and the whole reset of how we work occurring, on the one hand, what I remember so well is people who were working, who kept their jobs, mm-hmm. worked around the clock. Everybody was always working. And then it got to a point where even on like on a Zoom call or whatever technology people were using, they didn't even stand up, go to the bathroom, eat. It was just constantly working. So there is now a new kind of reset. When you talk about rest, creating boundaries, it's much harder, even in a hybrid environment, to have boundaries if a lot of the time you're working at home.
I agree. I'm one of those people that will find myself sitting in my kitchen here for hours and hours with no break, back-to-back Zooms, and then you're catching up on emails, and next thing you know, you haven't eaten, right, till dinner time, and then it continues, right, into late at night. And that is entirely unhealthy. I'm sure even if my staff came to me now and said, hey, this is what I'm doing, I would tell them to stop. My board is telling me to stop, right? Like, we have to create cultures of wellness in our workplaces. Like, it's not sustainable. And this is why we have high turnover. We have people dissatisfied in the workplace. And so we've got to actually, you know, as leaders in our organizations, have to do things a bit differently, knowing that COVID did change the rules and did provide us with more flexibility, but it shouldn't be at the expense of having some balance and wellness in your life, right?
And so for that, the office politics of that, like the peer pressure of, I'm always going to be there. How do you shift that understanding that we really do need to take a break? If you're in the middle, like if you're a manager, then you can institute policies. If you're in the middle, how can you, what can you do if right now there's more support needed around that?
Well, I think it was better when you were in person, right? Because you can come in, you could have breakfast, you could go to the water cooler, you could do lunch with your peers, your boss, whatever. And then you would leave at a certain time, right? Reasonable time. And then maybe, you know, depending on your job, no one expected you to work at night.
That's right.
So that is what I think we have to figure out how to, you know, given how flexible you need your day to be, get back to that, right? Like, I like doing hybrid now because I can go to the office and see my coworkers. I think it's really important to do some in-person time. That is truly how you build relationships, how you build the political clout, right, in your office to move and be able to have upward mobility. I think it's very difficult to do it fully remote because how do you meet everybody, right? You have to actually know who to meet. Yeah. So how do you do that? So I think we're still figuring that out, right? But, you know, I hear of jobs that are fully remote and that might work for some people, but I think, you know, if you're really looking for a pathway to navigate laterally and upward, there is going to be some in-person time. And our, you know, our corporations are asking for that. Like, they are asking people to come back, right? At least hybrid.
And these are good reasons that you're describing, because, you know, I'm sure there are people in this gathering right now who are not so excited about the hybrid workplace because they liked being at home. But what you're describing, especially if you are strategically looking to grow your career, having that face-to-face, in-person interaction counts for a lot.
Yes. Yeah. And honestly, I miss seeing people, right? I miss seeing people in person, and there's no replacement for the one-on-one live interaction, right? Like, it gets tiring to be on Zoom or on phone calls. But anyway, kind of, you know, going back to like that early first, second job, right, in a firm, you know, some of the things that were really interesting that I did had a lot to do with finding, again, my peers that told me how to navigate internally the people, right? So in that environment, I had multiple bosses basically, because each partner, you know, could give me work. And it was understanding who has the good deals, who has the good clients that resonated with the things I wanted to learn, but also who was good to work with, right? Because there were partners that, and I got lucky early on, I had a partner that kind of took me under his wing and would ensure that I built relationships with my clients that were equally as strong as his. So he would take me to all the meetings. He would always introduce me and say, this is my associate. You know, if you need anything, call her. That's empowering me to be the client voice and relationship, right? Even though I know they really want to talk to that partner, inserting me helps to bring confidence to me. The second thing he did that I thought was really interesting is, especially if you're in a sales-oriented environment, you build relationships with clients outside of an office, right? It's going to sports games, eating, it could be golf, whatever it is, right? But being invited to that often didn't happen with the very junior associates. But he did include me, right? So part of that external personal time where you're really truly building those relationships becomes much more important. So even later on as a, you know, as I got more senior, I started to realize, you know, one way you build up your team is you've got to put other people in a position to lead and be successful. It's not just delegating, right? But it's also having confidence in them and giving them the tools so that they could ultimately make you, you know, irrelevant. And that takes a lot of courage, right?
To be able to say, so much courage. Many people are afraid to do it because they think they'll be replaced.
Yeah. And I actually want to be replaced one day.
Right. But it's a really wonderful, confident attitude. What happens if you don't have someone like that leader who wanted to cultivate you, who wanted to mentor you? If your boss isn't like that, what do you do?
If you have one boss, you find other people that do it sort of on the side, right? So in an office environment, I mean, there's no such thing as only one person holding the future in your hands. I mean, maybe if you're in a very small company, but in a larger institution, I think that you have to build relationships across multiple departments. And, you know, in fact, as you grow into a role, like understanding the whole business, right, is really important. So I found that, you know, later when I became general counsel, I had to learn the entire business. I had to build relationships with the leaders of every single department. And some were that challenging to work with, let's say. But part of what I had to do was sort of build a personal relationship. And this is something I've never forgotten. My boss back in the days when I worked at Sports Club LA, she came from the hospitality environment. And this was an early lesson for her. She always said, you know, we underestimate the power of relationships, but part of what make her and can make you very successful is building what we call the emotional bank account, right? So she said, we often underestimate those relationships at the lowest levels of an organization. Like we might think, oh, it's really at the things at the top that matter. But in fact, it was whether it's the assistants, it's even people down to those who clean your facility, like really understand because they know who pulls the levers in a group, right? They listen, they really get the power of, you know, and the complexity of relationships in a workplace. Whereas you're coming in and you may have no clue, and listening, but also building relationships with them was really important. And what I mean by that is literally, like she said, and I remember my boss, she knew everybody's name. Like it didn't matter what level you were at. She knew everybody's name. She knew their family, if they had children, their girlfriend, boyfriend, husband. And she said, this is why it's so important to do that, because you're building an emotional bank account. You're building a relationship that shows you care about this person. And later, when you have to give feedback or you have to relay a difficult decision, you built enough deposits, right? So that when something, you know, negative has to be relayed, it doesn't feel negative. It actually feels good, right? And this, I've never seen anyone give constructive feedback or even terminate someone and then have the person walk away and feel like, oh, that was okay. Because
of this building an emotional bank account.
Isn't
that's
that amazing?
A great idea. And so often people who are striving to reach the top overlook the people that they think are not important. And Noah says, practice kindness, practice excellence. So it becomes second nature always. And Rosalind, people equity.
And I'll tell you, like, it's often been the secretaries, the assistants, the, you know, the paralegals in my law firm days that actually helped me navigate the politics. They were the ones that said to me, Betty, this is who you need to get to know. This is coming down. Prepare for this. they were the first in the know for some reason, or because they had their ear to the ground, right? So knowing them and caring about them, it was sort of this reciprocal back and forth, right? And not that's always the way to, you know, navigate a workplace, but it is so important to have relationships across the entire ecosystem and never treat someone as a lesser.
So you became the first female Latina general counsel at this company. What was that like? Because being the first can have so many meanings. And how were you treated in the beginning? Did you feel any discrimination? And if so, how did you navigate that?
So I was the first GC for this company altogether. And then back in, this was, I don't know, 2008 or so, there was a study done because I got very involved with the Latino professional groups. And one of them was the group that HNBA, Hispanic National Bar Association, and they did a study around Latinas in the law and how few and far between there are. I mean, we know in the law, there's not as many women that rise to senior positions, especially in firms, but Latinas were really at the bottom, like less than 1%. And they also did a study of the general counsels across the country, the Latina general counsels. So one day, my co-founder for Amplify Latinx, she comes to me and says, Betty, you're the first Latina general counsel in Massachusetts.
Oh, wow.
We can't find any other Latina in the state that, you know, started as general counsel. You're the first. And then that we, you know, there was another friend of mine that was GC, but she became GC later in another company at Hood. And from there, we started to like track them. But I was just in denial. I was like, no way. I'm still really young. Like, it can't be that I'm the first. But, I, you know, according to what they found, they're like, you are the first. So I felt this heavy, you know, sort of burden now to prove that we have to be examples and role models for those that follow. And that's partly why I ended up launching Latina Circle, Amplify Latinx, which was an initiative to help more Latinas get into positions of power and influence across. So that
national platform, Betty?
It's Massachusetts, but it's gaining a lot of interest in terms of how we do it to expand nationally. Yeah. And in effect, it's a network. It's a network of women, mostly professional women that commit to supporting each other through mentorship, championing, but to focus on getting into roles of leadership and decision-making, right? So it could be corporate, it could be to get on boards and commissions, and we champion each other. So I recommend a lot of women, you know, to new positions. And we also try to create visibility because this is another workplace politics issue, right? Is that oftentimes we're in the work as women, we're focused on doing a really good job, we're putting in the hours, but we don't get recognition. No one notices, right? And part of what we can do for each other is to make sure that we're giving each other the visibility and acknowledgement for what we're doing, both internally and externally.
Let's talk about that. How can one build visibility in a corporate setting? You know, because as you say, people have their nose to the ground, working hard, making the effort to be as strategic as possible. But that's a whole nother job, building visibility in a sense.
Yeah. You know, partly it's visibility amongst those that can influence, right? So, you know, I raise my hand a lot to do things that were stretch opportunities for me, that were ways to learn something new, but ways to work with somebody I wanted to work with, right? So if there's an opportunity to work with, you know, a leader that you haven't, and if there's rotational opportunities, right, in your job, take them, because it's a way to build not your just your knowledge, but for others to get to know you in a large institution. And sometimes we don't, you know, like if you're already stretched and feel like, oh, I can't, I'm over capacity on that, talk to your manager about doing that. Because again, a good manager is going to want to help you build your skills across the entire organization. You know, another way to build visibility is to do things like not part of your job. Like there's probably committees, there's probably employee resource groups that you can join and be a part of. You could help with volunteer activities, right? Take up a cause in the workplace. So I have found that doing things externally, like for example, when I was both in my firm and in this as general counsel for Sports Hub LA, I did a lot of stuff externally, which built my visibility in the community. So that was through boards, commissions, through starting up Amplify Latinx. And so I developed this reputation, right, for being a community leader, but also an ultra connector to Latino talent. So other corporations, right, would come to me and say, hey, how do I like connect with, you know, more women, more Latinas or other people of color? Because either for recruiting or for maybe leadership opportunities, especially for boards and commissions. And I knew like I could meet you and I could figure out based on a quick conversation, what are your interests? What are your passions? What are your skill sets? And then I'd recommend you for something like a board. We sometimes feel like we don't have time or why should I care? Believe me, like when someone cares for you, and I have found when I've championed someone or nominated someone for an award or just a recognition, you know, outside of their job, when their employer finds out about it, they're like, oh my God, right? Like,
somebody else is seeing
you. Somebody else is seeing you. So isn't that the ultimate way, right? To boost somebody. And just, I mean, there's no other word than just make them visible so that they then get other opportunities. And that's helped a lot because sometimes in the workplace, we are just not getting seen. But others see you for the things you're doing externally.
Betty, I'm wondering, you know, like you say, raising your hand is something that's so important. There are people raising their hands who feel like they're getting overlooked. There are people who put ideas out there. And we've heard this from so many women. And then a man in the room says the same thing right after and people hear him and didn't hear her. Mm-hmm. How do you gain that visibility that is yours if it seems like someone else is stealing your shine?
I mean, it takes a lot of courage to do this, but sometimes it's saying, oh, thank you for reiterating the point that I just made, or appreciate that you thought that was a great idea. Cause I, you know, and to build on the thing that I just said that Charles over there just validated, right? Like give yourself the credit and don't be afraid to do that. But it takes courage,
it
right?
Really
you might
does.
Feel like, oh, what, how sassy of her to say that. But the other thing that we can do, you know, as peers, mentors, just good colleagues is when you experience that and you hear it, that's when it's happening to your peer, is to say it, right? Is to say, oh, that's great, Charles, but, you know, and Sally just made the point too, right? Like made the point earlier, like it's to acknowledge that someone else did it first. And believe me, that stops them on their tracks.
Yeah. For anybody to say it, to speak up on someone's behalf, but also you appreciate it so much if one of your colleagues has your back, right? That you don't feel like you're out there on your own. Right. We gathered a few questions from folks internally. Here's a really interesting one. How do you handle an insecure boss? So you just talked about, you know, when you're confident, you want to help build up your employees so that they could replace you. The insecure boss who is like the opposite and really can feel threatened by an employee. How do you handle that?
I mean, I've found is figure out what they're insecure about and make them look good. Early in my career, I remember one of my mentors said to me, you know, what in how to deal with partners, because there's such a power dynamic, right? You're like, oh, this person like has my future in their hands. And they said, you know, in the end, if you make that partner look good, you're going to be so respected. Do whatever it takes to make them shine and look good. And that is what I found helped me build the relationships of trust to get the good work and to build myself up. And so I found like, if you can understand what is the person worried about, what's the insecurity, and help them shine or give them credit. Everybody wants acknowledgement and recognition, right? Just acknowledge like, wow, you did that so well. Again, over time, I started to learn that feedback should be reciprocal. It should be mutual, right? It shouldn't just be your boss telling you how you can do things better, or what you did well. A good boss looks for feedback on how they can be better as a manager and leader. And part of that is acknowledging you know, gaps in how you lead. Hmm. And I think if you can, you know, build that rapport with your supervisor, it just makes it for all the more better of a relationship because you're helping each other, right? And again, in a multi-generational workplace now, we have to do that. We really do.
And it can be tough. You know, the idea of feedback for some people is punishment. You know, I think maybe that comes from maybe how they were reared or who knows where that's coming from. But for a lot of people, it's a trigger. Right. And so if you find that feedback creates a trigger, what can you do in order to make it a more welcoming experience?
I mean, part of it is a mindset. So I think of feedback as a gift. If you think that feedback is criticism, then you may have your own like barrier up.
Right.
So I think we all have to improve across different things. We have to build different skill sets. And so feedback is the only way you can get better, right? If no one gives you feedback, I remember first 3 years of my job, nobody gave me feedback. Everyone was like, you're good. I was like, am I that fabulous? Right? And that's actually the worst thing you can do is not give someone feedback because then they have no idea where the areas that they're good at, what they should keep doing, and then what areas should they look to build or change, right? It doesn't help you like get other skills either because you don't know what you're missing. So feedback is both, you know, how can you improve what you're doing, but also how can you actually create a pathway to build the skills you need to get into the next role, right? Or to reach your ultimate career goal. So I think if you think of feedback that way and also know that sometimes it's not going to be what you want to hear, right? Like you might hear stuff that doesn't feel great, but know that it's there to make you better, right? And then the other thing to keep in mind is there are some people that give feedback badly. Like they're just mean, right? So you got to like separate the meanness. And then at some point too, if like it's just hurting you, because I do think feedback sometimes can like deflate you, right? And create a lack of confidence. If it's doing that, and again, I believe in being really open with the person giving you feedback, like clarify the feedback, try to understand where it's coming from. And what it is like, if someone says, look, like you're really disorganized, you need to do better at organizing yourself. And you're like, well, I don't understand, where is that coming from? Clarify it. Like, was it related to a specific project? And then look inward and say, could I have done that better? Maybe I need some project management skills and I should develop those, right? So feedback is how you deliver it, how you receive it, and then clarifying it so that it's actually helpful to you. But so remember, think of it as a gift.
I love that. Feedback is a gift. Everybody, I hope you heard that. And if you have a different relationship right now to feedback, consider adopting Betty's relationship that feedback is a gift. I want to share with you that there have been some studies conducted that say that women, and in particular, women of color, and even more specifically, African-American women, get the least amount of specific feedback of anybody in a business setting. Mm-hmm. You know, least specific. You did great, even if it's not great, or something really general that doesn't help to move people forward. If any of our members are in a situation like that, how can you find someone who will give you honest feedback about your performance if you don't seem to be getting it from your boss?
Get it from someone that you worked with on a project together, right? Get it from your peers, or, you know, it depends on what you worked on. Like if you're in a team, there's the, what we call 360 feedback, peer feedback and your supervisor feedback. And that might not always be internal. It could be from a client. It could be from a partner, right? That you have responsibility and relationship with, like ask for that feedback. Because that's really important how you are perceived externally with client relationships, right? Because if clients love you, they think you like you go above and beyond, that's another validation, right? And so I think early on, I wanted feedback so badly, but I wasn't getting it. Mm. And I learned how to ask for it, right? So I would actually say, I did this, or I wrote this, or what do you think of this? How can I actually make this better? like really going deeper and saying, what can I do better on this? Because if you're like, is this okay? And someone really doesn't want to get into it, they'll just say it's fine. Maybe because I didn't get feedback is why I'm so open to giving feedback today, right? And you mentioned that dynamic around women of color. I think we are afraid, right? To, you know, I have heard from my white women bosses say, well, you know, I'm afraid that you might perceive it as being racial. Okay, well, why do you think that, right? If you're just commenting on a skill or commenting on how to get a job. So, and that is such a disservice to us.
It right? is.
Because then we can't improve and we find ourselves like kind of here and we're like wondering what the hell are we doing wrong? And it's because no one's really giving us that tough, you know, and sometimes it is tough love.
That's absolutely right. We've got some comments and questions. Vidya says, as a people manager, I'm required to develop and grow all in my team and recognize, but while I am doing that, it takes up so much time and energy. I've been asked, what is it that you have done? How do you answer and negotiate this?
People development tends to be this occasional thing, right? Mm-hmm. It's like you have performance reviews once a year. Maybe you do them twice a year. Maybe if you're lucky, you have a whole performance management framework, right? For how do you develop people? So I think as a leader, as a manager, right, understanding like what are the skills that a person should be building? Do I even have those skills as a leader, right? So it's really understanding what that is. But I think is doing it really frequently, right? So again, like a work in progress for me, right? But even today, when I see something that needs to be addressed, I do it right away. I don't wait for a week or until your performance review to tell you, right? And I think of it as coaching, right? You're a coach as a manager. You're developing this person to be their best self. And so how do you take different examples of both what they did really well, like, wow, you led that meeting really well. Here's what you did that I loved. You really engaged the audience here. Or wow, you got that contract or that sale. Here's what went so well. I love the way like you shifted that tactic. Or here's how we could have done this better. Or you asked that. And then the other thing I do in my own office is creating these feedback loops, these feedback conversations and reflections, right? So when something, maybe it didn't go so well. A meeting didn't go that well. Or somebody says, we go back and say, let's do a reflection. What went well? What didn't? What can we learn? And then sometimes we institute like some change in the way we practice, or we just acknowledge like, this was good, this was not great, and here's how we get better.
You do that
regularly? After every meeting, but especially where things were not as effective as you wanted. It'd be great to do it after, but think of it, then you're adding more meetings.
That would be overwhelming. Yeah.
But do it as, you know, if you have a staff meeting or a team meeting, take 5 minutes and say, let's do a reflection on that thing, that particular thing you want to talk about.
And I like that, Betty, because there is an expectation that this is part of the work experience. So it's not like, oh, we just got called into a meeting, you know, it's regular part. Here are a couple of questions. What do you do if your feedback from peers and reports is different from your manager? How do you help your manager see the positive perspective of your work? How do you adjust what you are doing to respond to your manager to improve without losing those positives?
So I've seen that, right? Where as a manager, I'm evaluating someone and what their peer in the 360s, their peers say about them is very different from the interactions I've had. So what that signals to me is this person is managing up, possibly, maybe working as well or treating their peers in the same way. And actually, again, because the feedback is there, like in these reviews, when this happens, you don't disclose like, or you don't say, oh, so Johnny said this about you, but you say like the feedback is mixed. So let's talk about that, right? What might be contributing to this disconnect, right? And how you're perceived. So I actually, again, because I think feedback is so important. And when you have people saying inconsistent things about you, it means there's something's going on with a relationship. And they might end up saying, well, actually I had a situation with so, and this is what's happening. You then learn, or you help guide that employee around how to address conflict, right? So I think the other issue we haven't talked a lot about is how do you deal with conflict, right? How do you
address conflict about it
in the workplace? But oftentimes that comes back in, you know, 360 feedback, like this person isn't good. Like they get angry or emotional, or they actually challenge people too much, right? And create a conflict. Being a lawyer and having done some mediation training, I kind of have taken the approach of having these set, you know, one-on-one conversations, and then sometimes bringing people together to help address a particular problem, conflict, and figure out, okay, how do we set some ground rules to work together? You know, it's sort of wearing a bit of an HR role. Like you might say, I don't have time, I'm going to help HR do that. But as a manager, right, where you've got a team, I think it's important to help people navigate that too.
You know, I spoke to a woman who ran HR for NBC Universal some years ago, Paula Madison, amazing woman. And she said to me something that I thought was so brilliant. When you walk into your review, your performance review, you should already know what is going to be reflected back at you, because you should have been engaging with your manager the whole time.
Right.
And very often people don't do that. And, you know, performance reviews are coming for everyone who's gathered right here, right now. What can you recommend to them that will help them when they get to that state?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Performance reviews should not be a surprise. So having watched like reviews being done in such a positive way, it's when the employee comes in, you ask them first, rather than going down the list of like, this is what you did really well, and here's where you need to improve, is start with, you know, what do you want to talk about? Like, how do you see your role here? Where do you want to go in this organization? Like, it's really getting an understanding of how does the person see themselves at this time in this environment? And come armed, right, with the things that you did well, like your accomplishments in your role and your job, because your manager may know, but you want to remind them, right? Where the areas that you want to develop further. Right. So we all have issues, right, that we have to work on, things we want to get better at, but talk about it as areas for development. Like, this is where I want to grow. And you, manager, help me with accessing training or giving me opportunities that help me build these skills. Right. And then be clear about where you want to go. Like, where do you see yourself in the organization? Like, I want to get to this. So back and forth of how do I get there? What do I have to develop in terms of skill sets and relationships to get to that ultimate destination? I often think reviews are more about like, here's the good, the bad, and that's it, versus how do you grow? How do you develop? And sometimes it's developing out, right? It's saying you've capped your ability to grow here, and now it's time to maybe think about something else, not here. And that's okay. That's okay. Absolutely okay. Again, a good leader knows when someone has reached their peak in a work environment, because maybe there's no additional upward mobility, right? Or what they want to do can't be pursued in that organization anymore.
And I've talked to a number of corporate women who have shared that when there was no way up in a particular department, et cetera, they looked laterally and ended up in many instances doing lateral jobs and then being able to rise up in the company because they were willing to do those lateral moves. What do you think about that?
I think that's actually one of the best ways to build your career, especially if you want to be a CEO. So if you want to be a CEO, a C-suite leader, you actually have to learn the organization inside and out, right? You have to learn sales, marketing, finance, accounting, all of it. And that's what I loved about being a lawyer, right? Not that I knew how to do all of it, but I had to have like a understanding of all of it. So I kind of learned, you know, when you're a GC, you learn the whole operation, what makes this business tick? What are the levers? How do I protect it, right? And it puts you like as an advisor to the CEO. So, you know, if you can think like that, no matter what role you're in, but how do I develop an understanding of how to operate this business? It means going into lateral roles.
Mm-hmm. Here's a question. Is it okay also to recognize that you need to protect your own brand and reputation and put the leader and their thoughts on a lower level of importance, or maybe not be so invested in their feedback because it often comes from a place of manipulation.
Yes. If that is what you're feeling, look, there are bad bosses, right? There are people that really don't care about you or your development, or, you know, maybe they don't, it's just a job for them, right? So I have found that comes intuitively, like you sense that's the case. I do believe that there's always good in people, but if you feel like this person is not looking out for me, you know, and they're impacting your brand and your reputation in the workplace, I think it's time to move on. I don't say it lightly because I know a lot of folks don't have the luxury of just switching jobs, but I think it's important to know when, and the minute you identify two things, like my boss is not helping me be a better person or, you know, employee, or I've capped the things that challenge me, then it's time to go.
And go doesn't always mean leave the company, but it may be that particular
That particular person, right? Mm-hmm. Now it's time to go to this other department to develop a different skill set. Yeah.
We just have a few more minutes. I know that you have a family. You're married and have two children, correct?
Yes.
How do you juggle family and all the things that are part of the family dynamics and building a career in the way that you have? Because a lot of people believe that you can have one or the other.
It comes with a bit of sacrifice, right? Mm-hmm. So I would say I've been the kind of mother that has felt that career is just as important as family. Like family does come first, but career is very important. So balance is probably a really a tough word to use because I feel like I lack balance very frequently. But as I did it, you know, in my other conversation with my husband, a lot of it is having a partner, right, that is supporting you at whatever you want to do in your career at that moment. So you're making trade-offs with each other, right, in terms of who does what at home, who does what at work. If you are in a position to have help, right, with childcare, early on when my kids were young, we didn't have family that could go pick up kids. You know, we couldn't do daycare. We actually didn't get into daycare. We were on a wait list. We couldn't even get into one. So we ended up hiring a nanny, which became like a family member. So she was incredibly flexible and could, you know, stay really late. So the times when both me and my husband were out at events or networking, building our careers, right, we had someone that could care for our children. And then every little bit of time we had, we spent with our children. So I sometimes ask, because my kids are now, you know, one's going to college and one's going to high school, you know, and I ask, like, you know, has this affected you? Like mommy being always so busy? And they will tell you, they will say, you're on the computer all the time. You need to stop. Like, you need to pay attention to me. And then, you know, like, ooh, I do need a break. I don't know if I shared this in my other webinar with you, but during COVID, when everybody was at home, you know, and one of those wellness checkups, the pediatrician said, you know, your kids, and I think every kid had some mild depression, right? And the doctor says to me, you know, do you have family dinners? And I said, actually don't. I mean, we never really had consistent family dinners. And she said, so you need to start now. Set a goal 2, 3, 4 times a week. Sit down, you'd be surprised what you'll hear. And we started to do that and we would play Uno together. Oh my God, the revelations from these dinners, like it is the way you hear and they express themselves because there was no other space to do that. And the thing is, some of it comes, like, I didn't grow up with family dinners. I grew up with a single mom. She never had time to sit down with us. So culturally, it wasn't a family tradition, right? So, you know, but making it one now is so important.
So important for mental health for the whole entire family. Yeah. This hour has zipped by, Betty.
Yes.
Wow. Thank you so much for talking to us, just sharing so many great insights. You really did give us a lot to think about and to put into action right away.
And one last thing I'll tell you is have somebody, 1, 2, 3 friends that are your confidence around what happens at work? So I have like 2-3 people that I share my workplace challenges with or my journey as a leader. Mm. And having someone that you can be really honest with and talk with that's like outside of your work is such a help too. It gives you so many insights. It can validate some of what you're feeling, but also make sure that you're not keeping yourself stuck.
And also it is taking it away from work because okay. talking to your colleagues about it is a really bad idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Betty. Take care, everybody.
Thank you. Have a great
day. Have a great day and make it count.
Thanks for listening. We appreciate you choosing to spend your time with us. If you love this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe. If you'd like more information on how we empower professionals mid-climb, visit our website at kahila.com. That's kahilla.com.
And as we say at Kahila, step up into your boldest self, and while you're up there, reach down and help another person up.